You're listening to Now I've Heard Everything, conversations with the icons of our time.
I've always said the Palestinian is born with a sense of responsibility and with a historical risk. So you are either a potential victim or a potential maker and shaper of reality.
Longtime Palestinian politician Hanan Ashrawi. Today on Now I've Heard Everything, I'm Bill Thompson. Throughout the 1970s and 1980s, the most prominent face of the Palestine Liberation Organization was its chairman, Yasser Arafat. In the early 1990s, though, the PLO put out a different spokesperson, a well-dressed, articulate woman in her 40s named Hanan Ashrawi. She became well-known to American television audiences as a sharp contrast to the Arafat image. I met her in 1995 when she wrote her autobiography called This Side of Peace. And given the context of events happening today, her remarks of almost 30 years ago still resonate. So here now, from 1995, Hanan Ashrawi.
Why did you write this book?
Well, I wrote it because it had to be written, basically. It's a book that uses the first-person account as a vehicle for the collective reality. And it's a book that I wrote, I described it as an amana, a sense of commitment, discharging a sense of responsibility, a trust that I have. First of all, to capture a chapter in history where, from my own little corner, I participated in the shaping of it. And also with a group of friends and colleagues who worked very hard, who took tremendous risks, and who were worried that their chapter in history might be lost. So they said, you write it, because if you don't, either somebody else will write it and distort it, or we will never get to know the whole truth. So in a sense, I also wrote it as part of what I felt was a commitment to the human reality of the Palestinian people, and as part of the responsibility of being a spokesperson. And to make people aware of the multifaceted peacemaking and peace process, the peace process that we were involved in, the fact that there are so many sides, and this side is the personal side, the human side, the Palestinian side, the inside side, and being on the receiving end of peace, and the side that nobody sees except those, you know, the external side of spectacles and fanfare and signing, and everything looks beautiful from outside. But when you look at the real substance, you will see not only how much it costs, but what a precarious process it is.
You're right. To the outsider, to the observer, let's say, it looks so neat and clean-cut and orderly, especially when we hear about the Oslo Channel and how everything fell right into place and everything was so neat and nice. And to read your book, again, the insider's account of things, not only was it precarious, it came dangerously close to falling apart on more than one occasion.
Absolutely. It was a process that needed constant intervention and constant an act of will to sustain it at every minute. And it was always threatened with collapse or with implosion, and we had to bear it, so to speak, and to sustain it ourselves. At the same time, the peace process that we have now has become a diminished process and one that does not do justice to the rights or aspirations of the people.
I was curious. I mean, as a child growing up, you don't think, well, someday I'm going to be a spokesperson and be part of a peace process. I mean, where did you plan to be when you were a child? Where did you plan to be at this stage of your life?
Well, we've never had the luxury of actually planning. All I knew was that I had this tremendous fascination with academics. I mean, I knew I was going to be an academic because I really loved scholarship and education, and I chose the most esoteric subjects. And I said, there's this pedantic streak in me, you know, whether in Renaissance textual criticism or in medieval literature or then in comparative
literature. That's just going to be on the test.
So in a sense, I mean, if I had the luxury to choose, I would choose academics. I would choose literature. I would choose a very calm and comfortable life. where occupation doesn't exist, injustice doesn't exist, threats and danger don't exist. But unfortunately, being born a Palestinian doesn't give you much choice. I've always said the Palestinian is born with a sense of responsibility and with a historical risk. So you are either a potential victim or a potential maker and shaper of reality. So I chose not to be just a passive victim, but to be part of those who shape reality and who have the will to intrude and to change our course.
But how much easier that would have been if you had been a man?
Certainly, yes, of course. Men, have things ready-made, the advantages, the discourse, the orientation, the structures, the support system. But at the same time, how much less fascinating if I were a man. And probably how weaker. Because in a male-dominated society, when the man sort of takes things for granted and has things prepared or ready for him, he doesn't have to face challenges all the time. He doesn't have to solve Gordian knots every day. He doesn't have to prove himself every day. So it doesn't sharpen your spirit or your soul, so to speak. But being born a woman meant you have so many different dimensions, so many aspects to your own struggle, whether at the individual level, at the gender level, at the human level, at the national level, and you form a sort of composite, holistic approach, either in fighting injustice and oppression, or in asserting your right as a human being, or in translating self-determination to be a comprehensive governing principle of reality.
I have heard more than one journalist, Western journalist, say that you may have done more than anything else to help the Palestinian cause in the West by representing a contrast to the image that the West had had before. The Yasser Arafat image, the unfortunate, the violent, the terrorist image, if you will, the clashes that we saw in the evening news. Here was this refined, well-dressed, attractive woman putting forth the Palestinian effort, the point of view in a thoughtful, rational, considered way, and the West began to listen. Is that an accurate assessment in any way?
Well, there is an element of truth because, in some ways I took the world by surprise. Because they were governed, this audience was governed by stereotypical assumptions, by convenient labels, by reductive simplistic generalizations. So in a sense, by conveying and presenting a human reality which has existed all the time, but which nobody bothered to see, because it was much easier to deal with the convenient label. In a sense, I defied those stereotypes. And not alone as a human being. I mean, it was also part of the Palestinian struggle as a whole and the different dimensions of it and the Intifada itself that made people question their assumptions and the givens. We have been labeled not just as terrorists. Historically, we were either refugees or terrorists, or we were the exotics, the Orientalist tradition of Edward Said. Or in less complimentary terms, we were called at various times two-legged vermin, cockroaches, the dogs, the non-existent Palestinians. Remember when Golda Meir said, "Who are they? They don't exist." Or even sometimes we were abstracted into numbers, that desensitized people to the nature of the human reality of Palestinians. Everybody assumed, 15 Palestinians killed today, that's a matter of fact. There are 15 or and so on. 12,000, 15,000, 30,000 Palestinians in jail. That's a fact of life. These are numbers. So I tried to give all these. First of all, I tried to challenge and to break through these barriers of misconception, these stereotypical attitudes, and at the same time to give the numbers a human substance and to say each person has a name, a face, an identity, hopes, aspirations, parents, children, sisters, brothers, dreams. And that human substance has always been the focal point of everything I've done, whether in the political arena or in the literary arena or in the resistance arena. The question was one of affirmation and transformation of discourse and the recreation of images so that the image would suit reality, rather than attempting to make reality conform to an image.
After this short break, Hanada Shraoui reflects on how she's managed to survive all this time.
Start your day with Now I've Heard Everything.
We post new episodes every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 5 o'clock a.m. Eastern Time.
Subscribe now so you'll have something fresh to listen to and get your day going.
Now back to my 1995 interview with Hanada Shraoui.
I also couldn't help wondering, as I was reading various parts in your book, as you, when you joined the Intifada and got very active at a time when you could have simply retreated back and into a life of comfort, why aren't you dead? I mean, why are you still here?
Yeah, that's quite a relevant question now that you've asked it. I have, you know, seen the machine gun quite up close several times. I have been in close proximity with death, and it's true. I don't know why I'm... Maybe fate intervened at points to save me.
It's not because you didn't take risks.
No, I certainly did, because, as I said, I don't want to be a passive victim. And so, I mean, I'd rather not die as somebody who became cannon fodder to a situation not of her own making. But I'd much rather take risks in the pursuit of peace and removal of the causes of conflict and injustice than just take the risk of merely existing as a Palestinian and being a passive victim. I don't think you can live where I've lived and the way I've lived without having fear, but you cannot make it an overriding factor in your life. Because a fear that paralyzes makes you withdraw, incapacitates you, and it's a negative motivation. There is a certain amount of healthy fear in everybody which allows you not to take stupid risks. But I hope to have that amount of healthy fear that makes me take precautions. But at the same time, I really haven't had time to stop and say, I cannot do this, it's too dangerous. I've always said it has to be done. And I've moved so fast on several fronts at the same time that I guess neither fear nor death had time to catch up with me.
Let me ask you about something else, if I may, because you tell an interesting story. We all saw the White House signing ceremony in the fall of 93. We all witnessed this historic moment that almost didn't happen.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it was... the politics of brinkmanship par excellence. I mean, we could have collapsed at the last minute because of the nature of the wording in the document. It was agreed that the Palestinian delegation would be changed to read the Palestinian Liberation Organization. And when we got to the White House lawn, we discovered that it hadn't been changed. First of all, we had to negotiate intensively up to the last minute to get the agreement to change the text. And then once we got the agreement, got to the White House lawn, we discovered that they hadn't changed it. So I had to rush and make sure. That's why the signing was a few minutes late. I mean, the schedule was worked down to the last second.
We just thought it was Bill Clinton.
Yeah, it certainly wasn't. It was the nature of the document. But I used that not just to show the precariousness, the last-minute nature of things, the sort of how close to the abyss we came, but also... to show a transformation, symbolically, from the Palestinian delegation to the PLO and the taking over of the official sort of leadership from the delegation that had undertaken the process so long.
Well, what is going to become of Jerusalem now? Because as I understand the original agreement, the talks were to begin no later than next year, but in today's story is that Israel does not want to reopen the talks.
Well, the thing is, they postponed central issues in the agreement without getting assurances and guarantees that they would not be preempted by one side, that Israel would not exploit the time to create facts that would, you know, prejudge the outcome of negotiations. And Jerusalem is a focal central issue. It's really the acid test. So, of course, Israel proceeded to create facts, to expand settlements, to confiscate more land, to annex Jerusalem, to legislate in order to undermine Palestinian rights in Jerusalem, so that by the time they got to permanent status negotiations, there'd be nothing to discuss. And unfortunately, the American position hasn't helped much at all. And this latest veto at the UN, to me, is a disaster. It's a direct blow to the peace process, to American credibility as a co-sponsor, or as an even-handed peace broker. The Americans have come out and taken sides, so to speak. They have subjected Jerusalem to electioneering and campaign politics. And that is extremely dangerous, because they're giving away what doesn't belong to them. And in doing that, they are really striking at the integrity of the process and at the standing of the U.S. And they're threatening the peace process with collapse. And I frankly think that if this continues, then there's no sense in having a process whose outcome has already been predetermined on the basis of self-interest and power politics.
Will it aggravate things if the U.S. moves its embassy?
Yes, the Congress, unfortunately, which is supposed to represent the will of the American people, is representing the need to get elections money or to launch a campaign, and in catering to special interest groups, and in attempting to win certain votes, they are meddling in issues that they shouldn't meddle in. American policy and international law state that Jerusalem is part of the Palestinian territories occupied by Israel. If the U.S. does move its embassy to Jerusalem, it means that it has violated American policy, international law, and the peace process. And it means it disqualifies itself from the peace process, and it has really negated the process as a whole. So I don't think you will find a single Palestinian who will accept the continuation of the process or the American role if this embassy is moved. I think the veto itself was a tremendous blow, a betrayal and a disappointment. And I'm surprised that the process is still going on, frankly speaking. But the repercussions will be felt not just in Palestine, in the Arab world, in the Islamic world. These are dangerous waters. And I believe that they are rushing in where angels fear to tread. They must be very careful, and they must maintain a minimal level of credibility and integrity if they want to play a constructive role in the region.
Hanan Ashrawi is 77 now and continues her work as a civil society activist. Now you can get a copy of This Side of Peace by Hanan Ashrawi by tapping the link in our show notes or by going to our website, heardeverything.com. We may earn an Amazon commission if you make a purchase. HeardEverything.com is where you can also hear my 1989 interview with the former Prime Minister of Israel, Ariel Sharon.
The only thing that we ask is to be able to live normal life in our one small, tiny country.
And my 1997 interview with the widow of the man who stood next to Yasser Arafat and shook his hand on the White House lawn that day in 1993, Yitzhak Rabin, my interview with his widow, Leah Rabin.
I have remained as the symbol of what he was for them, the man that desired to make peace, the man that had respect for the Arab world, the man that they could trust.
And of course, we post new episodes of Now I've Heard Everything every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and you can find us everywhere you listen to podcasts. And thank you so much for listening. Next time on Now I've Heard Everything, he made the Columbus Zoo famous, and he became a celebrity in his own right. My 1989 interview with Columbus Zoo director Jack Hanna.
People can relate to animal stories. It's a fun thing. Everybody relates to animals, both as far as stories or visiting a zoo, and I think that's what's really fun about a zoo.
That's next time on Now I've Heard Everything. I'm Bill Thompson.